All right. So thanks to Dan for the great job of introducing me. The one thing that I wanted to add is that you might have also heard of me from the work that we did on MD5 collisions, and in particular, the generation of a rogue certificate authority that was trusted by all the major browsers using an MD5 collision. This was something we did last year with a great team of researchers, and it was quite popular. But today, we're not going to talk about MD5 collisions. We're not going to talk about SSL. Today, we'll focus on vulnerabilities and exploits. So I've been doing exploitation since 1999. I think this is when I first wrote my first exploit. And it was quite fun at the time. But exploitation has gotten a little bit harder with the years. So first, let's start with a few definitions. So a vulnerability, when I talk about vulnerabilities, I mean flaws in the code of some kind of program that have a security impact. In this talk, I will focus specifically on memory corruption vulnerabilities because these are the most popular ones out there. They typically give you the most access to the applications, and also these are the types of vulnerabilities that I have spent most of my time researching. But vulnerabilities by themselves are not enough. If you have a memory corruption vulnerability, you can trigger it, you can crash the application, but so what? You've taken care of the availability, but the confidentiality and integrity are still there. You haven't really been able to tamper with any data on the system. And if you want to get more access to the system, more than just being able to crash it, you need to be able to run arbitrary code in the application. This is the ultimate goal that most people who deal with exploitation have. And the definition of exploit, which is what I'm going to use, and this is also the widely accepted definition of an exploit in the exploitation community, is a program that generates some kind of data. It could be a request, it could be a malformed file, some kind of malformed packet, some kind of data that corrupts memory in a way that gives the attacker control over the execution of the program. This could be achieved by injecting arbitrary code into the program and getting the instruction pointer to point there so that you can execute it. It can also be achieved by subverting the logic of the application to make it go down a path that it's not supposed to go. For example, you can use this to bypass authentication. Maybe you have some kind of function that the application uses, and this function is supposed to be only called when the user is authenticated. If you can subvert the logic of that authentication check, or perhaps you could override the instruction pointer and make the program go to that function, then you can achieve those results without any authentication. And this would be a security flaw. So this is the definition of an exploit. And I put this definition here because I have seen a number of people who've used slightly different definitions. For example, there was a paper, I think last year or 2 years ago, from the BitBlaze folks, who did some great work on trying to analyze patches and automatically generate programs that could trigger the vulnerability that was being patched. And even though the work was great, they kept using exploit in their paper every time they talked about the programs that they were generating. But those programs are not really exploits, because all they could do was trigger the vulnerability. And perhaps 10 years ago, this would have been enough, because exploitation was much easier back then. But today, getting from being able to just trigger the vulnerability and get a crash to actually controlling the application execution to the level required is much, much more difficult. And with that, I'll draw your attention to this slide I have up here with a very unscientific graph. You'll notice that there's no numbers on it. There's no scale. And the curves look a little bit too smooth. This is because I drew them in Word. What this graph is supposed to show is my personal experience with exploitation. So when I started doing exploitation back in 1999, you could find a vulnerability. It wasn't very easy because our vulnerability finding techniques have improved significantly since then, but people were finding vulnerabilities. Once you found a vulnerability, getting from the vulnerability, which could be a string copy buffer overflow, it could be a heap overflow, getting from the vulnerability to having a complete functional exploit that gives you a remote shell on the remote server, that was maybe a days of work, maybe a couple of days. An experienced exploit developer at that point could just knock these out in no time at all. At that point, the value of the vulnerabilities was much, much greater than the value of the exploitation work necessary to take advantage of the vulnerabilities. So there's no distinction between the people who found the vulnerabilities and the people who did the exploits. Typically, they were the same person, and the exploit work was just, you know, a little insignificant development time that, you know, you just put to finish your vulnerability and get an actual exploit. In 2004, which is a very important year, and I'll go over this in the next couple of slides. I actually have a special section that talks about the summer of 2004. So in 2004, things were even better. We have discovered a number of new classes of vulnerabilities, like format string bugs. Our vulnerability finding techniques were even better. Fuzzing had gotten much more popular, and through fuzzing, you could find a lot more bugs much quickly. But exploitation hasn't really gotten any harder. You could read Aleph One's famous FRAC article on exploiting buffer overflows, which was published in 96 or 97, and you could apply everything from that article to exploiting modern operating systems in 2004. There's no difference at all. So we had even more vulnerabilities, and they were still just as easy to exploit. But after that, something happened. And what happened was the introduction of the exploit mitigation techniques in operating systems. Windows XP Service Pack 2 was one of the first mainstream operating systems to include them. Today, most of the operating systems, with the exception of OS X, have these kinds of have some kind of exploit mitigations. And those exploit mitigations have been continuously improving over the years. And you can see this on the graph. They, even though we keep seeing papers and we keep seeing talks about how the exploit mitigations can be bypassed, you know, if you just look at that in isolation, you would get the impression that, okay, so they're useless. You know, why are we even spending time on designing better exploit mitigations? Well, they actually do work. Even though almost all of them can still be bypassed, bypassing them requires a significant investment of time and effort and expertise. And this is reflected on the right side of the graph, where you see the red curve, which represents the difficulty of exploitation, going up and up and up. And I believe that at some point, which I'm not sure if this was a couple of years ago, or maybe it's 2009, maybe it'll be a couple of years from now, at some point we will reach the inflection point when the cost and the difficulty of finding vulnerabilities actually becomes much less than the cost of exploiting them. and there are already some isolated cases of that happening. For example, I have this just personal anecdote. I ran a fuzzer against a fairly popular app. I got 100 different crashes, which were probably not 100 vulnerabilities, but still, there were some vulnerabilities there. And it took me like a day. After that, I spent 5 weeks working on a single exploit for a single one of these crashes. And talking to other people who do exploitation for a living or who are heavily involved in this type of work also confirms that they're experiencing the same thing. Dave Itell, who has a company that sells exploits and sells penetration testing tools, he has said, repeatedly that often his team would spend multiple man months on a single vulnerability to get it to work. And as a proof of this, you can look at the VMware exploit that Kostya Korchinski, who was one of the researchers working for Immunity, he described this exploit at Black Hat. It was a great presentation, a lot of very intricate detail about the steps that you have to go through to exploit a vulnerability of this kind. And it did take him a very long time because he had to jump through a lot of hoops to get reliable code execution. Plus, the environment was novel, the environment was unusual, you could not use some of the standard techniques. He had to come up with new techniques and new approaches to exploit that particular vulnerability. And this is not that unusual. So here's what I'm going to talk about today. This is the general structure of the talk. So I'll go over, first I will start with an overview of how we exploited vulnerabilities back in 2004. Hopefully this will not bore you too much if you already know all of that. But I just want to show the baseline that we're starting from. Then I will talk about the exploit mitigations that have been added to operating systems, and particularly Windows. I'll focus on Windows because this is the operating system that matters most when you're dealing with exploitation, and also because most of my work has been on Windows. But practically everything that I talk about is also applicable to Linux. The defenses on the Linux side are mostly the same, maybe not in practical implementation, but the theory behind them is the same. So I will go over the different exploit mitigations, and I will show their evolution. I'll show how we got an exploit mitigation in one release of Windows, and then that exploit mitigation was broken through a new technique, and then the mitigation was improved in the next release, then it was broken again, then it was improved again. So through this, you can see the continuous improvement of the exploit mitigations. At the end of that, we'll get to the state of exploitation today, which is what you have to do if you want to exploit vulnerabilities on modern systems. And when I say modern systems, I don't mean XP, because XP is about 80 years old at this point. And even though it does have some mitigations, they're much, much weaker than the ones available in Windows Vista and also Windows 7, which is coming out shortly. So if you want to do cutting-edge exploitation research, you need to look at Windows 7. An even better target would be the experimental exploitation mitigations that are they're coming out on the Linux side, GR Security and PAX in particular. So once we're done with that, I will move on to what will happen in the future. Of course, I can only speculate, but I will try to go over different ideas that people are thinking about, different directions for possible research that could provide some useful techniques for exploiting vulnerabilities, even in the face of all of the exploit mitigations that we have currently. And hopefully this will inspire perhaps some of you to go and research this topic and then tell me how I can exploit vulnerabilities that currently I cannot. I would be very happy. So let's go back 5 years ago, almost six actually at this point. So in 2004, we had a large number of vulnerability classes that were already well-known, well-researched. We haven't really gotten that many new ones since then. It seemed like the large, significant vulnerability class was the integer overflows and the sign-in issues, which were identified, or I'm sure they were known before then, but they became more prominent in the early 2000s. Since then, we haven't really seen a new class of vulnerabilities arise that had such an impact as integer overflows or the format string bugs had before them. So we had a number of vulnerabilities. We had a number of vulnerability classes. We had pretty good tools for finding these vulnerabilities. I already talked about how fuzzing made everything so much easier and made finding vulnerabilities so much more effective. And this is something that's still continuing. I mean, there has been a number of really good papers done on how we can make fuzzing even more effective. So this is an area that is being continuously worked on and improved. And the best part about 2004 was that all of the old exploitation techniques that we've had since the 90s still worked. There was nothing stopping us. You could exploit pretty much any vulnerability. And let's go into the more technical details. So here's a very basic stack overflow on Linux. And I'm not gonna show the standard C code with a string copy call in the stack overflow. You've all seen this. But here's how you actually exploit the stack overflow on Linux. So you have a buffer in memory that is being overflown. You overflow the buffer until you reach the return address of the current function. And you override that return address with a value that points back into the buffer. And this is possible because on Linux, back in 2004, the base of the stack was at a fixed location. So you knew where your stack would be located, you knew how much stack the program would use to reach the vulnerable function. So the address where your buffer would be in memory would be the same or very slightly moved on all kinds of different systems. So you could point the return address into the buffer and the program would return there and start executing code. Of course, back then, the stack was also executable, so any code that you put there would just run. I mentioned that the address was not very easy, was easy to predict, but not necessarily accurate. So to get around this, instead of just putting your shell code directly at the address where you jump to, you put a long string of no-op instructions before the shell code. So then even if the buffer is shifted by a little bit, it doesn't matter because the program will jump into the knob instructions and then slide down that knob slide until it reaches the shell code. So this was easy. We've known this for a long time. On Windows, it was a little bit more complicated because many applications were multi-threaded, and with multi-threaded apps, you don't know which stack your request would be processed by. So to get around this, you would override the return address with a known location in memory in one of the system DLLs where you had a jump ESP instruction. So the program would return to the jump ESP instruction, and that instruction jumps back to the stack, and it's a indirect jump. So whatever the value of the stack pointer is at that point, that's where you end up. And all you have to do is put your shell code right after the return address, and the program will start executing the shell code. So this was simple. A lot of the exploitation research at that point, and research is kind of a loose definition here, A lot of that work was focused on how do we build better databases of possible trampoline addresses that allow us with a single address to exploit multiple versions of Windows, multiple language releases of Windows, multiple service packs. The Metasploit project, which publishes a lot of good exploit tools, they had a huge database which you could query and you could find the best trampoline addresses to use that were valid across the largest subset of Windows releases and application releases. Now on Windows, there's one more feature that made exploitation of Stack Overflows even easier, and that is the structured exception handling. Now for those who might not be familiar with it, structured exception handling allows applications to register handlers that handle access violations and other types of exceptions that occur in the program. And some of those might be application exceptions. For example, the C++ exception handling is built on top of the structured exception handling. But even in C code on Windows, you could register these exception handlers and catch OS exceptions, such as access violations, divide by zero, and you know other types of events. So, the registration of these exception handlers was in a record, 8-byte record that was put on the stack. So each function that wanted to register a record like this would put the handler on the stack, or it would put the record on the stack. And then that exception record would point to a function, which was the handler, and then it would point to the next handler. So basically, you had a chain of handlers that were linked up, and the entire chain was on the stack. So when you did a stack overflow, you could override the exception handler, and that was just the function pointer, which pointed to a function. You could point it to your shellcode. And when you override the exception handler, you don't need the function to reach the point where it returns. You could just trigger an access violation, which was pretty easy. You just override one of the arguments of the function, or you know, if it takes a pointer argument, you override it with null, the program gets an access violation. So basically, you could just corrupt the whole stack, and it didn't matter what the function did after the overflow. As soon as it hit an access violation, it would call your exception handler. And one more detail, you don't point the exception handler directly to shellcode because that wouldn't work for some technical reasons. You point it at a trampoline that pops two values off the stack and then it returns. And because of the way the stack is set up, when the exception handler is invoked, that actually jumps to your shellcode. So that also, there was a great exploitation technique, very reliable, and because it was so easy to do, there was a number of tools that people had built that automatically exploited Stack Overflow exploits. You would just give the tool you would tell the tool how to send requests to the vulnerable server if this was a server process. And then the tool would use a debugger that was attached to that server to monitor how the server crashes. So the tool would just send a long string of A's, and then it'll see the crash, and then it'll figure out where the exception handler record is on the stack, and how many A's you need to send to reach it and to overflow and to override it. And then the tool would automatically build up the exact request that you had to send to exploit the vulnerability. So at some of the industry conferences, there were a lot of presentations about this kind of work. Of course, all of it died out after the exploit mitigations got introduced, the exploit mitigations that stop exploits like this. But this is what we did back in 2004. All right, moving on. Format string bugs, they're also very easy to exploit. Format string bugs would allow you to override an arbitrary location in memory with an arbitrary 4-byte value. This was the basic primitive, the basic exploitation primitive. It was an arbitrary 4-byte write. Once you had that, on Windows, you could overwrite a function pointer in one of the standard libraries. Kernel 32, for example, had a very good function pointer. That was a function pointer that was called whenever there was an exception that wasn't handled. So you could override that pointer and then just corrupt enough of the memory to hit an access violation. And that access violation would most likely not be handled, and it would reach your function pointer and then execute the shellcode. So that worked pretty well. On Linux, people did it by overriding the global offset table in any ELF binary. You override the global offset table entry for one of the functions that will get called after the format string attack, and then you just get your shellcode to be executed. And again, because the stack was predictable, the stack was at a fixed address, the heap was also easily predictable, you could just put your shellcode, you know, somewhere on the heap or somewhere on the stack, and you could easily target it with one of these attacks. All right, and then heap overflows were another very popular attack that we did back in 2004. I guess heap overflows are still popular, but the way we exploit them today is very, very different. So in 2004, we had a very, very effective generic attack against the heap allocator itself. So this allowed you to take any heap overflow. It didn't matter what block was located after the block that you are overriding. And you would corrupt the heap header that was located after the block that you overwrote. So on the diagram there, you have the buffer, and then you have the heap block header. This is the header of the next heap block allocated right after the buffer. In that heap block header, you would have the forward and the backward pointers that were used to link heap blocks in a doubly linked list. And this was just a standard doubly linked list. And you had this function there called unlink, which removed an entry from the doubly linked list. And it just takes the forward pointer and it reads the forward pointer of that and it writes it into the previous block. I guess it's kind of hard to explain, but this is what the code looked like. And whenever when you triggered a heap free operation on the block that you've corrupted, that unlink operation would give you an arbitrary 4-byte write. Basically, it would write the value of the back pointer into the address that was pointed to by the forward pointer. So you just point the forward pointer to, you know, someplace in memory where you have a function pointer, and then you point your backward pointer to your shellcode, and you're done. You get your arbitrary 4-byte overwrite. This was a great technique because it required no knowledge of what the application did with the heap, and it was also generic, because almost all applications use the same heap implementation provided by the system library. This technique would work on pretty much every app. And the best part was that the exact same technique worked on both Windows and Linux, which, even though they had completely different heap implementations, they actually used a very similar format with a doubly linked list. So this was a great attack, and we were all very saddened when it stopped working. On the other hand, once that attack stopped working, we actually had to do much more complicated heap analyses and heap manipulation, which I enjoyed researching. So it did provide me something to brighten my day. So here's an overview of what we saw. Just going over how to exploit different types of memory corruption, it's not that interesting. It's just little technical details. But once you go over enough of them, you can extract some kind of meaning out of them, some kind of pattern. And the pattern that we see from these exploitation cases that I went over is the following. There are a number of OS features that we rely upon. If these OS features are modified, it would break all of the exploitation techniques that we used to use. And here's the specific features. The first one is the stack and the executables are located at fixed addresses. This allows us to target our buffer on the stack when we do a stack overflow. This allows us to target a trampoline in a system DLL, such as the jump ESP or the pop ret sequence. And if the stack and the executables and maybe other things in memory are not loaded at fixed addresses or addresses that can be predicted by the attacker, then those techniques wouldn't work. If you don't know where your shellcode is in memory, how are you going to get arbitrary code execution, right? You can't just blindly jump somewhere and hope that your shellcode is there. That wouldn't work. That wouldn't be reliable. The second pattern that exploits relied on in 2004 was that you had function pointers at well-known locations. And one solution for that is to randomize the addresses where your binaries are being loaded. Another solution is to encode the function pointers. Recent versions of Windows use this pretty heavily to protect various pointers. They XOR the pointer with some kind of random value. And then every time they want to use the pointer, they just XOR it back. And because the random value is different on every system, the attacker doesn't know what value to put in the pointer when they override it. And instead of targeting the attacker's shellcode or the location that the attacker is trying to go to, after the XORing, that would just point to some random place in memory, so the app will just crash. The third pattern is the heap allocator. And particularly the feature of the heap allocator that makes it trust the data on the heap. I misspoke. It's not data, it is metadata. And this is a very, very important distinction. There are some allocators, the one on BSD, for example, that do not mix the heap data and the heap metadata to the extent that the standard Windows and Linux allocators do. For example, on BSD, when you allocate some blocks, there's a heap header that has a bitmap with that tells you which allocation, which blocks are free, which blocks are allocated. And then after that, you have all of the user data. So on BSD, if the attacker overwrites a heap block, they will not overwrite the metadata of the next block. They'll just override the data of the next block because all of the metadata is in the beginning of that large chunk. So on BSD, all of these standard heap exploitation techniques never worked. And this is one case where a better design of a heap allocator can help you prevent a lot of attacks. On Windows and Linux, however, this was not the case. So you could very easily corrupt the metadata, and then the allocator would follow those pointers, and it would do things that perhaps it shouldn't do, like overriding arbitrary memory with arbitrary values. And then the final point is that back then, on almost all architectures, and especially on the x86 architecture, which is, again, the one that matters most, the stack and the heap were easily executable. because the processor, like even though the operating system supported marking the stack and the heap as non-executable, the processors just didn't have the feature that allows them to catch execute access to writable memory. So this made it very easy to just introduce new code into an application by putting it on the stack, on the heap, and in that case, arbitrary code execution is very, very easy. So these are the features that all of the exploits relied on. Can those features be modified? Can the exploits be broken? And the answer is yes. And we saw this in 2004. So this is why I talked about the summer of 2004, because this was the last great summer before XP Service Pack 2 and Red Hat 3 Update 3, which started introducing these anti-exploitation features. And actually, when you're talking about the practical value of the exploits, it was a couple of years until those systems got deployed widely enough that exploits didn't work in the real world. So maybe in the summer of 2005, you could still exploit vulnerabilities with these techniques, just not on the latest and greatest versions, but you could still exploit them on versions that a lot of people still used. But by now, certainly, pretty much any deployed system is going to have all of these defenses and more. So what did we get in 2004? Well, we got a non-executable heap, non-executable stack. This was also done in collaboration with the processor vendors, both AMD and Intel, who actually changed the design of the processor to support this new feature. We also got stack cookies, which prevent stack overflows or detect stack overflows. Safe unlinking, which prevents the unlink exploitation technique for the heap. And some limited randomization, which attempts to make it harder for the attacker to predict the location of some data structures in memory. On Windows, the randomization was just of this structure called the process environment block, which contained some very good pointers that you could overwrite and gain control of the execution. So that data structure got randomized. On Red Hat, we got randomization of system libraries, but not of, I believe there wasn't randomization of the stack or the main binaries yet. So these are the first steps towards the towards better exploitation mitigations. And like most first steps, it was very easy to bypass them, but they got better with time. And this is the history of that. This is a table that I took from my old presentation from last year where I talked about the breaking the Vista exploitation mitigations. It just shows the general trajectory. These are in the rows, you have different types of mitigations. And in red, you can see the ones that are missing on particular Windows releases. So you can see that the exploit mitigations on XP were not as good as the ones on Vista, and then Vista Service Pack 1 got even better ones. So with time and with newer OS releases, we're seeing more and more, we're seeing an increase in the exploit mitigations. And this is not just an increase in the number of exploit mitigations, it's also an increase in their effectiveness. So here's the different exploit mitigations that we have. There are two main categories. The first one are exploit mitigations that try to detect the memory corruption. And if they detect it, they just abort the application, typically. And then you have exploit mitigations that try to stop common things that exploits do. For example, overriding the unhandled exception pointer is one of these common patterns. So if you move the unhandled exception handler, or if you XOR it with a random value, this will make it impossible for exploits to use that technique. All right, so the first one is stack cookies. So stack cookies are pretty simple. You just put a random value right before the return address, and at the end of the function, you check if that random value is still the same. If it is, then everything's good. If not, then there's been some kind of buffer overflow, and the stack cookie got overwritten, and then you probably want to abort the application. Breaking that was pretty easy. If you look at the stack frame in a little bit more detail, there is a number of other things on the stack that you could overwrite to gain control of the program execution, you know, other than just the return address. So you don't care about the return address anymore. You can overwrite other variables in the function that are being used before the function returns. You could also overwrite the function arguments. So a classic technique was if you have a function that has an output argument, which would be a pointer to some structure somewhere else, and the function writes some string into it, you know, perhaps a string that you control, because that's the data that the function processes, you could overwrite that output argument, and you could overwrite that pointer to point it anywhere else in memory. And then when the function writes that data, it'll write it at an arbitrary location in memory. So that turns stack overflows into arbitrary memory writes. You could also do the same if you have pointers like this in the function local frame. You could also overwrite function pointers and just point them directly to the shellcode. So there's a lot of stuff you could do. The answer from this was the GS variable reordering, which was introduced in the next release of the compiler. So when you have variable reordering, the compiler changes the order of the variables in the local stack frame to minimize the chance of any useful for the exploit variables being located after the buffer that can be overwritten. So it puts all of the buffers, all of the arrays, it puts them at the end of the stack frame. And then it puts all of the integer variables, pointer variables, you know, other types of variables, it puts them before the buffers. So now, if you have a buffer overflow, you cannot overwrite the other types of variables. Also, to solve the problem with overwriting arguments, the compiler would generate code that takes the arguments when the function starts in the function prolog, takes the arguments, copies them again before the buffer, and then never uses the original location for the arguments. So even though the exploit can still overwrite the original arguments, since they're never used, it doesn't matter. So with this, exploitation became harder once again. But then it turned out that there's more stuff you can do as an exploit developer. So if you look at the stack frame in even more detail, you'll see that there's three more things that you can overwrite. They're marked in red over there. So the first one is other buffers. If you have multiple buffers in the same function, even despite the variable reordering, you might still be able to overwrite a buffer that is followed by another buffer. So you can change the value of the other buffer. Now, how do you get code execution out of this? It's very vulnerability dependent. It depends on the particular application, what it uses that buffer for. But if it uses it for something important and you can modify the value, then maybe you win. Another problem that still exists is the arguments. The compiler doesn't actually copy all of the arguments for every function because that would be too expensive. It only copies some types of arguments that are considered more high risk. There are still other arguments that you can overwrite and perhaps use them to modify the execution of the program. And I'm not going to go into too much detail, but if you look at my paper from Black Hat, the one about impressing girls, if you look at that paper, I go into more detail on exactly what you can do there. And then the final thing is the, or next to final, is the stack frame of the color. A pretty common pattern is you get a function that allocates a, let's say, C++ object. It allocates a new object as a local variable on the stack frame, and then it calls another function, passing it that object using a pointer, you know, but passing it by reference. So if there is a buffer overflow in the callee, the callee will be able to overwrite the contents of the original C++ object, which is located in the stack frame of the caller. Once that object is overwritten, the callee might still use that same object, which it has a pointer to. So in that case, you could still get code execution. And then finally, you have the exception handler record. The exception handler is not protected by the stack cookies. So if an exception happens and you don't have any kind of exception handler protection, then it's game over. Despite the stack cookies, you can still exploit all stack overflows. So what do they do to prevent exception handler overwrites? They introduced this system called SafeSEH, which works like this. You recompile all of your code, and all of the libraries, all of the DLLs, and also all of the executables. You compile them with a special flag called SafeSEH, and that generates a table of all of the allowed exception handlers in each DLL. So now when an exception happens, the exception handler dispatcher, which is part of the operating system, looks at the DLL where you're trying to jump to. And if it has a table like this, it verifies that the address you're jumping to is found in the table. So this allows the attacker to only jump to valid exception handlers. So you can no longer jump to a pop-up ret sequence. Now, that has problems too. The main problem, and actually that's a problem that still exists, almost 5-6 years after the introduction of SafeSEH, is that there's a lot of third-party applications that are still not compiled with a compiler that supports it, or maybe they just don't have the flag. So, and this is very common in browser plugins, for example. There's a lot of browser plugins out there that just don't have the SafeSEH table in their files. And if you have a single DLL that does not have SafeSEH loaded in the process, that makes SafeSEH completely ineffective, because then the attacker just targets that DLL and they get their code execution. So SafeSEH kind of gives you all or nothing protection. And then finally, even if you have all of your DLLs have SafeSEH support, you still have the attacker still has the ability to call a different exception handler from the one that was intended to be called. So if the exception handler relies on some kind of other data on the stack, perhaps you could exploit that exception handler because it'll be executing at a point in the program where it was not supposed to. All right, so then we get to the next step. How do you solve these exception handler problems? And the scheme that one of my friends, Matt Miller, is his name. He works for Microsoft now. He came up with that. He actually came up with it before he started working for Microsoft. I think Microsoft licensed the scheme from him and then hired him. That scheme uses another property of the exception handlers. And that property is that they're all chained together in a linked list. And because of just luck, when the exception handlers were designed, back 20 years ago. It just so happened that in the data structure for the exception handler record, you have the pointer to the next record before the function pointer. So that means that to overwrite the function pointer, the attacker necessarily has to overwrite the pointer to the next entry in the chain. It is not possible to overwrite just the exception handler, unless the attacker can somehow skip over it. But in standard buffer overflows, this is not possible. So the scheme works like this. You put a cookie at the end of the chain, random cookie. Every time an exception happens, the exception handler dispatcher walks the chain, and it makes sure that it terminates with that cookie. If it doesn't, then the exception handler, one of the exception handlers must have been overwritten, which broke the chain. And because the attacker cannot guess the value of the cookie or the addresses of the other exception handlers, it's not possible for the attacker to make a correct chain. This is a very, very effective technique. I don't know a way to bypass it. The only good thing for the exploit writers is that it is not really deployed anywhere. It is present in Windows Server 2008, so I guess it works there. But in Windows Vista, even though they added the code is disabled. I'm not sure about Windows 7. I haven't checked yet. But there's a good possibility it will be disabled there too. And this is because there's a number of third-party apps that do just crazy stuff with the exception handler chain that break that. For example, Cygwin does not work if you have this exploit mitigation technique, because Cygwin creates a loop in the exception handler chain on purpose. If you Google for it, you'll find long discussions about how Microsoft broke Cygwin and how Cygwin developers were unhappy, and then they changed their code to use a different technique. I mean, they had a reason to use the loop. So you have a lot of these compatibility problems that Microsoft ran into when they tried to deploy this technique. So this is why they're not using it for consumer operating systems. It is used on servers. But if you're exploiting browsers, you don't have to worry about this. Okay, the next technique is data execution prevention, or also known as the NX bit, which I think AMD calls it NX, Intel calls it XD. I call it data execution prevention because that's the one common name. It's a pretty simple scheme. You just need to have your processor support that special bit for the permissions, and then your stack and your heap are no longer executable. So it's great, right? Well, turns out that a lot of programs actually want to execute data off the stack or off the heap. All of the JIT systems, the GCC trampolines that it was generating for nested functions, I think they fixed that, but back in the day, that was a big problem. Microsoft code also generates trampolines if you're using ATL. So there's, when they first introduced this, they ran into a bunch of different problems. So the solution was to turn it off by default. So now each application, and this is still true, even on Windows 7. Now each application has to explicitly say, I am compatible with DP, please turn it on for me. If the application doesn't say that, then you don't have DP. Browsers had a lot of problems with that because they use third-party plugins. Third-party plugins are usually really crappy. They're rarely updated. They don't support DP. Because of this, Internet Explorer did not support DP until version 8, which was released this year. Firefox did not support DP until version 3, I think, which was released last year. So until last year, you could exploit even the latest Vista system with all of these protections, and it just wouldn't matter because the browser just didn't have DP. Now, you have some more subtle bugs, too. Last year, when I was doing the research on browser memory protection bypasses, I found this very, very interesting problem that the Sun JVM had. So DEP does not prevent you from actually allocating memory that's writable and executable. Like, if you explicitly request writable and executable memory, you'll get it. My theory for what happened is that the Sun JVM people, when DEP was first introduced, they were like, all right, we got to make Java compatible with it. How do we make it compatible? Well, we'll just go to every place where we do a memory allocation, and we'll make it readable, writable, and executable. And this will solve everything. No more compatibility problems. And that worked. Java didn't have compatibility problems. The JIT allocator could allocate memory for the JITted code, and the code would run. But because they modified all of their memory allocators, all the memory that Java allocated on the heap for its data structures was also readable, writable, and executable. So if you had a browser exploit and you had DEP turned on, you could exploit it very easily by just loading a Java applet and running a little bit of Java code that allocates like 100 megabytes of just strings. And those strings would contain your shellcode, and they would be allocated on the Java heap, which is readable, writable, and executable. And then your exploit just needs to get the program to jump somewhere into that heap, and you would get shellcode execution. So I believe this problem has been fixed now, but there could always be other, you know, subtle problems like that. And then finally, you know, the thing that really, really breaks DEP on Windows XP is the lack of randomization. DEP without randomization is completely useless because you can use return-oriented programming, and if that's too heavyweight, you can use just a standard return into libc to execute not arbitrary code, but to execute to get enough functionality out of the program that you might not even need to execute arbitrary code. Now, when I think one of the first papers that was published on defeating DEP actually used a return to libc technique where they overwrote the return pointer with the address of some code that turns off DEP for the current process, because DEP could be turned on and it could be turned off. There was like a little, like a system call for doing this. So they just called the system call for turning off DEP, and now you can just execute shellcode from anywhere. That doesn't work anymore, but what I do today when I'm writing exploits that have to deal with this is I just use return to libc to call virtual alloc to allocate some new memory, and I request writable and executable memory. Then I do return to libc into memcopy, and I just copy my shellcode into the writable and executable memory, and then I just jump there, and I get shellcode execution. So if you don't have randomization, if you don't have SLR, then DEP doesn't really make a difference. So the answer to that is SLR. SLR, it stands for address space layout randomization. But it sort of rolls out the tongue nicely as an acronym. SLR randomizes the positions, the base addresses of the DLLs, the executables, the stack, the heap, and ideally all other data structures and things that are located in the process address space. If all of the executables are randomized, all of the executable code is randomized, then you cannot do return into libc or return-oriented programming. And that's kind of a problem. But it turns out that, again, like with every other technique that we discussed so far, compatibility reasons led to its downfall. So ASLR is also not turned on by default. It only gets applied to executables and DLLs that are compiled with that special flag that says, I'm compatible with randomization, please turn it on for me. And this is not a per process setting, this is a per file setting. So you can have your browser, which has everything randomized in its process in its address space. And then the attacker just loads a plugin that you have installed. Like how many of you use a Juniper VPN or something like that? VPN systems, anybody? Okay. I guess in more corporate environments, it's a little bit more common. The Juniper VPN, the Juniper VPN browser plugin, for example, doesn't have ASLR. So anybody who has that installed, the attacker just instantiates that plugin, which loads the DLL into the address space, and then the attacker has known code at a known location that they can jump to, and they can do all of the return-oriented attacks. This is one of the problems. The other problem is that, again, if you don't have DEP, which Internet Explorer didn't until very recently, ASLR by itself is completely useless. And this is because of heap spraying. So heap spraying is a very simple technique. It can be done in JavaScript. It can be done in any kind in Java, any kind of language that gives you, you know, memory allocation facilities. It can also be done even without scripting languages, just by sending large requests with a lot of data that the program has to allocate somewhere. So heap spraying refers to filling a large part of the heap with data that the attacker wants to put there. And this data is usually shellcode. Once you've done the heap spraying and you filled, you know, maybe 100 or 200 megabytes of memory with your data, then despite the ASLR, you would still be able to predict where that data will be. Because the memory space, especially on 32-bit systems, is not infinite. And you cannot randomize, you cannot shift it by too much. So on Vista, ASLR for the heap actually gives you, I think it only gives you like a plus minus 1 megabyte shift of where the heap starts. So if you just spray more than 1 megabyte of data, despite the shift, you will still be able to land somewhere in your data. So heap spraying is very effective, and we've seen it used for a number of browser exploits. All right, so what is the state of the art? If you're dealing with Windows 2000 or older versions of XP, you can exploit anything. There's no protections, it's trivial. But nobody cares about these systems anymore. Not even the attackers in the wild really care much about them, because most people are running more modern operating systems. XP Service Pack 2, and this also applies to Service Pack 3. There's no significant changes there. In that version of Windows, we do have some protections. We have the stack cookies, we have DEP. But they're largely ineffective. And we've seen a number of exploits that are done. A number of exploits are used for mass attacks. You know, all of those people who do the malware, botnets, keyloggers, you know, all of those people, they usually target XP because this is the most widely used operating system, the most targets, and it's also fairly easy to exploit. So despite the exploit mitigations that we have there, there's still many different ways you can bypass them, and they're all public. So it does not really present a significant challenge. So the state of the art in exploitation has moved beyond XP Service Pack 2. Now, when we get to Vista, things get a little bit harder. Vista browsers are still fairly weak, but the server applications on Vista are pretty well protected. Since they're all Microsoft-based, they all have DEP and ASLR. you know, most of the compatibility problems are with third-party applications, but if you're sticking just to Microsoft code, things will generally be well protected. In browsers and other client software and also third-party apps, ASLR and DP are still not used very, very effectively or very thoroughly. So there's a lot of attacks that you can do there. Now the main thing that limits Vista exploitation is there's not that many Vista systems to exploit. Most people don't run Vista. Most people stick to XP, which is actually even easier. But this is one of the reasons why we have not seen very many mass attacks that bypass ASLR and bypass DP, just because they don't have to. They just target XP. But with Windows 7, I think we will see some, because Windows 7 is, if you follow the press, and if you believe the press, it's supposed to get more deployment than Vista, hopefully. Microsoft hopes so. Everybody who's used it says that it's a better operating system, but I guess that means better than Vista, which is not very hard to beat. But if it is actually better and people finally decide to upgrade to it, we will probably see a lot more of these exploit mitigations become a real problem for exploit developers. There has been improved support for DP and ASLR from third-party vendors like Adobe Flash and the PDF Reader, QuickTime also. They finally added support for these mitigations. So now if you have a fully updated system with the latest versions of all plugins, you're in a much better shape than you would be like maybe 1 year ago or 2 years ago. So I think that things are about to get challenging. So when they get challenging, what do? We respond to the challenge, if we can. I've done a lot of talks about how to exploit browsers today using insecure third-party plugins, compatibility issues. I mean, all of these are, you know, very effective techniques, very practical, but they're not very future-looking. If you look at the future, you'll have to ask yourself, how are we going to exploit software vulnerabilities when you have something like Windows 7? And you assume that all of the applications and all of the code follows all of the best practices in regards to the exploitation defenses and turns on and opts in into all of those mitigations, you know, all of those optional mitigations. What are we going to do then? All of the bypasses for ASLR, for example, that I just talked about, which is sort of where the state of the art is. You know, a lot of these bypasses rely on compatibility issues. So if you don't have to worry about the compatibility issues, what do you do? And this also applies to these mobile devices that that we see now. The iPhone, for example, nobody has been able to run arbitrary code on the iPhone with version 3 of the operating system, because the kernel actually checks the signature of every page of code that gets executed. And if it doesn't have a valid Apple signature, then you can't execute it. They've been able to do return-oriented programming on the iPhone, which is still possible because they don't have randomization. But as soon as they add randomization, which shouldn't be that hard, what are we going to do? We can't execute arbitrary code because of the DP. You have full ASLR. We're kind of in a bind. So here's just a list of possible techniques that could work. A lot of them are kind of vague and not yet fully researched. And I'll also go over, you know, future directions of research, which could be useful for exploitation in the future. So the first technique is partial overwrites. We also lucked out. And we lucked out because Intel is a little endian system. This means that if you do a memory overflow and you overwrite the first two bytes of a pointer, you'll actually override the low order bits of the pointer. And in Windows, the randomization is only on the high order 16 bits of the address. So the low order bits would always be constant. What this means is that all of the libraries, all of the DLLs are aligned at 64K. So if you can modify the low 16 bits, you can change a pointer to point anywhere else within a 64K range in the DLL. This is a pretty effective technique. I actually used it for, I didn't use it. One of my friends came up with it and used it for exploiting the ANI vulnerability on Vista. And it worked really well there because we were able to find a jump ESP instruction that was within 64K of the of where the return address normally pointed. So by doing a partial override on the return address, we could point the return address to that jump ESP instruction, and then we would just jump to the stack and execute shellcode from there. The problem is that exploitation is vulnerability specific, and it requires some manual effort to figure out what to do. Second problem, the second technique that could help us is memory disclosure. And this has also been called information disclosure or information leaks, memory leaks. Memory leaks are probably the most common term, but I don't like it because memory leaks also means something else, which is not what we're talking about here. So memory disclosure means that if you can read the memory of the remote process somehow, maybe there's some kind of bug that just allows you to read a little bit more from a string than you should read. If you can do that, and you can get some kind of memory data from the app, you can bypass SLR. It is sufficient to get a single return address from the stack, just 4 bytes, to fully bypass SLR, because with that return address, you'll be able to determine the allocation base for one of the DLLs, and then you can do a return-oriented attack using that DLL, and then you can bypass both SLR and DEP. So that's a very good technique. The problem is that there's not very many bugs that allow you to do that. And one of the directions for future research is how do you find more bugs that specifically give you memory disclosure? Or if you have a large set of bugs that you found maybe through fuzzing, how do you find out which ones of those give you memory disclosure? So that's something that I would like to see somebody look at. And the other thing that still works pretty well is an entropy attack. SLR on Windows only uses 8 bits. So if you can try your exploit 256 times, you're going to win. In most cases, it's kind of hard, but there might be some situations where you can get multiple tries. For example, Internet Explorer 8 now has this feature where if a browser tab crashes, IE will automatically restart it with the same URL. So you can try again, and again, and again. It's limited to 5 times, but that still lowers, it still lowers the randomization and increases your chance of success. If you can find other ways to recover from crashed applications or just repeat the exploit multiple times, then ASLR would not be a problem. Another very cool technique, which my co-author from last year, Mark Dowd, came up with, is virtual shellcode. And this is a particular case of a data corruption attack. So virtual shellcode idea is that you write your shellcode using Java, for example, not native code. And in Java, each Java applet has a particular security context associated with it. It's also verified by the bytecode verifier when it gets loaded. So Mark found out that by overriding a single byte inside the JVM, inside the data section of the JVM, you can turn off the bytecode verification. And there's actually a flag that says, you know, bytecode verification turned on or turned off. So by overriding that flag, you can load any applet with corrupted bytecode, and you all know what corrupted bytecode or unverified bytecode means. It means full control of the Java runtime and full access to the system. What also worked great is that last year when he, you know, first published that, the JVM was not randomized. It did not use ASLR. So you actually had a fixed location in memory where you could override a single byte and get shellcode execution. You could also do this in .NET. Other types of systems that have a similar security model, this would be possible. Now, ASLR presents a challenge here, but you know, perhaps there's ways around that. So this is one area that, you know, I really think that there's going to be very good exploitation techniques that will come out of this. Just because if you're not dealing with native code, then a lot of the exploit mitigations just don't matter. So if you generalize this kind of attack, you get to corrupting application data. If you have a heap overflow, you can overflow the data that follows your block. There are techniques that allow you to control the heap and get a block that contains something useful to be placed after the block that you overwrite. My heap feng shui paper from 2007 talks about one particular way you could do that. There are many others. So if you can find a heap block, a heap allocation that contains some kind of useful data, and you place it after the heap block that you overwrite, and then you override that data, you could use that data to modify the way the application behaves. Maybe that heap block that you override contains some kind of authentication data. Maybe it contains, you know, some kind of security context, or, you know, I don't know what could be relevant, but if you look at the application, you'll probably find some types of data that overriding which would give the attacker control over the application. So this could be a way to defeat ASLR and DEP as well. And by defeating DEP, I mean we just sidestep DEP because we're no longer interested in executing actual native shellcode or even virtual shellcode. We're just, you know, modifying the application logic to make it to do something else. So here's four different directions for future research that I wanted to suggest to whoever's interested. And I will certainly keep working on these. But I think it would be great if more people do so. So the first one is, how do we get memory disclosure? Are there new classes of bugs that we have overlooked because they're not useful for the old style exploitation, but would be useful for getting memory disclosure? Are there better ways to get the existing classes of bugs to give us memory disclosure? Can we somehow generalize that problem? So that's a very important question. Second one, when you're exploiting partial overwrites, it's a lot of work. You have to find just the right sequences of code in the application to return to, and you're somewhat constrained in what code you can execute because you have only 64K of code to work with. Can we automate that? That problem is kind of similar to the return-oriented programming problem. It's just, you know, a slightly different variation. Number three. Controlling the memory layout of a process, controlling the heap of a process, the heap allocations and where they're placed, is a very important part of a lot of these new exploitation techniques. Right now, to gain good control of the application heap requires a couple of weeks of work with a disassembler and a lot of manual analysis using a debugger just to find the right parts of the application that give you heap allocation patterns that are useful for controlling the state of the heap. It would be great if we could have if we could find some ways to automate that problem. One other useful thing would be, you know, to answer the question of how can we find useful data to override? Like, how do I know what variables are relevant to authentication? What variables are, you know, how do I know what variables I can override leading to a change in the application's behavior that is useful to me? I mean, I can change the application behavior in many ways, but which of those changes actually help exploitation? That's a very hard question. And if you don't have source, and usually you don't, that's an even harder question because you don't even know how the program is structured. So you have to reverse all of it. And reversing is hard, takes a lot of time. Better techniques for controlling the heap. I mean, we do have some pretty solid ones for making sure the two blocks are next to each other. But if that can be extended to give us even more control, then that would be useful. Another thing that some people have worked on already is if you have an uninitialized variable problem in the code, where it uses a stack variable or a heap variable before it's initialized, then its value would depend on whatever was in memory at that point, at that location in memory before you reach this code. So how does the attacker get control of that value? And there was a talk about this that Halvar Flake did at CANSEC West 2 years ago, I think, that talked about how to solve this for the stack case. And from all possible paths through the program, how to find paths that you could go down that give you control of that part of the stack, and then go back and go down the path where that value from the stack is used without being initialized. So he had some static analysis techniques that helped with that problem. But how do you do this for the heap? That's an open question. So in conclusion, exploit mitigations really do make a difference. They make exploitation harder. It is not yet clear if they'll stop exploitation completely. They might stop exploitation of most memory corruption vulnerabilities, but certainly we'll always have the web and all of its brokenness to look at. These are very hard problems, that's why I find them interesting. So, if you have any questions, feel free to ask. You can also email me at my email address. Later, but yeah, thanks.
Yeah, Rick Farrow. What happened to format string vulnerabilities? Because, you know, you talked about, boy, it would be so easy if we could just see what their stack pointer is, and that was a good way of doing that in the past.
At this point, format string vulnerabilities are extinct. Mm-hmm. As a species of bugs.
Just because you could do a string search and find.
Yeah, they're just so easy to find that they've been found.
Okay.
And almost all of them have been found already, and it is very unlikely that we'll see major flaws that result of a format string bug.
Thanks.
It's really sad.
So you mentioned a number of in your final slides, you mentioned a number of techniques which would basically places to look for new vulnerabilities and to make finding exploits easier. Looking the other way, are there any mitigation techniques that we could that have not been implemented or that have not been? Do you see any mitigation techniques that would make your job even harder as an exploit writer?
Certainly.
That haven't been done but should be?
Certainly. but I will not tell you what they are.
Thank you kindly for that wonderful presentation. You didn't mention anything about VM environments and how that affects memory. Could you just sort of discuss that at all in terms of exploits?
By VM, do you mean virtualization, like VMware type?
Yes.
I don't think that really affects memory, because like if you're trying to exploit Windows running inside a virtual machine, its memory looks just like the memory of a Windows running on a native hardware. Like it doesn't really affect the heap or the stack or anything else. So basically, it doesn't matter. The only place where virtualization matters is if you're actually exploiting a bug in the virtualization product itself, like Kostya's VMware exploit, for example. You know, he had to worry about how VMware handled memory. But for any other type of vulnerability, that just doesn't matter. And that's one of the strengths of virtualization. It gives you an environment that looks just like a normal machine.
So you mentioned that it's easy to find vulnerabilities. However, it seems like developers know that these their code is vulnerable, and they're more careful now to write good code. Have you seen any effect? Has that put a dent at all in the number of vulnerabilities?
Oh yeah, certainly. I said that it's getting easier to find vulnerabilities, but to find vulnerabilities, they actually have to be there. We've definitely seen a significant improvement in the quality of the code that Microsoft is producing, for example, because of their SDL process. Fortunately for the exploit people, there are not very many other companies that have adopted a similar process. So the code quality of other software is generally pretty low. For now, it is pretty easy to find vulnerabilities in software. Maybe it's not Microsoft software, maybe it's other software. I don't really deal with finding vulnerabilities as much as I deal with exploiting them. So I haven't really looked into that particular problem. I do realize that if the developers just get so good that they don't put any new vulnerabilities in, and we fuzz out all of the old vulnerabilities, then entire classes of bugs could go extinct, just like the format string bugs did. That would be a problem. But I think that in general, to underestimate the capacity of developers to put new bugs in is something that we should not do. And we've seen this happen over and over again with different technologies. We sort of kind of figured out how to write native system code that is not vulnerable. If you're like very diligent, you can even do it in C, even though it's hard. DJB can do it. Most mere mortals probably can't. But they can use Java or .NET or any other type-safe language that reduces the number of vulnerabilities significantly. So we sort of figured out how to do it for native code. And then what happened? Well, we got the web. And the web has completely new classes of vulnerabilities that have nothing to do with string copy buffer overflows that still allow attackers to get in. So I think exploitation will continue regardless of what its target is.
Hey, so as we move towards, mobile phones are obviously sort of taking off, and it seems like there's more and more devices in the home where you have like sort of much stricter memory constraints. It seems like a lot of the mitigations that people are relying on aren't going to work because you have less entropy, and it's just a much more difficult problem to leverage randomness.
That's a problem. So perhaps exploiting embedded devices will remain they will remain an easy target, even though normal desktop and server operating systems are not so easily exploitable anymore. There's probably other types of mitigations that could work even in constrained memory environments. That's another good area of research if you're on the defense side. But yeah, you're right. There is a problem with embedded devices. All right. Thank you.